today on iPhone or Android.
Hey, it's Tom Kandel from Curtain Call. This week on the show, we travel back to the Catskills in the summer of 1969, when the world was watching the moon landing and thousands were heading to our area to see Woodstock. I'll be joined by composer and lyricist Anne-Marie Milazzo and Drama Desk award-winning actor Andrea Burns to talk about the new stage musical, A Walk on the Moon. We'll learn all about its unforgettable characters, its beautiful score, and the powerful family story at its center. That's Curtain Call, Monday night at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
Good morning. Welcome to Catskill Character. I'm Donna Fellenberg. Each week, I introduce you to the fabulous characters of the Catskills and beyond. Today, our guest is Sullivan County's Myron Gattell. He's an author, a historian, an RN and EMT, and a former waiter at the Concord in the days when the Borscht Belt was bustling. Myron took one weekend off from the hotel in August 1969 to attend the Woodstock Music and Arts Fair. Years later, he wrote the definitive account of the emergency medical response at the festival, Woodstock 69, 3 days of peace, music, and medical care. Myron is still researching that history, and we'll hear about his latest quest for lost Woodstock artifacts later in the program. For now, let's start at the beginning and learn about his early days and how he came to the Catskills. Please enjoy this fascinating conversation with a true Catskill character, Myron Gattell, in conversation with Radio Catskill's Jason Dole.
Myron, welcome back to Radio Catskill.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Listen, I just wanted to start off by getting you to give me just a little bit of idea of what your early life was like. We'll talk about how you came to the Catskills, but like, where'd you grow up? Who were your parents?
Brooklyn, Crown Heights, standard stuff. I mean, you know, probably with 50% of the people here. Yes. Mother Brooklyn-born, father Brooklyn-raised. Kind of right in the middle of the borough, Crown Heights. So pretty rock-solid, middle-class upbringing.
Yeah, what was it like there at that time, in those years?
Very standard, very safe. Kind of controlled in a non-controlled way. You know, you had your parameters of where to go and what to, and you know, it just seemed so freer compared to you were the subways. You had a subway, you had 10, you were riding the subways literally by yourself, 10, 11. The buses, you would walk to wherever you were going. And my parents were warriors, but in those days, parents didn't worry. Unless they came late and I didn't call. But even when I say a 10, 11 run, that's not an exaggeration. I was a little big for my age, so.
And like a lot of Jewish families in Brooklyn at that time, your folks would come up here to vacation?
Yeah, well, first we went to a place, it's interesting, in eastern Connecticut, Moodus, Connecticut, which was a known Jewish resort area of about 30 hotels, small hotels. Then after a couple of years we came here, we started at the in Swan Lake at the Vacation Land Hotel. Then when that burned down, we went to the Fieldstone Hotel in Swan Lake. And then when that burned, then we went to the Swan Lake Hotel in Swan Lake. Now, what was very interesting and wonderful, what a bunch of luck, that had had a fire the previous year or two. And because of that, the dining room was burned down. So what they had, it was European, all the hotels were American plan, three meals, and that was European plan because they didn't have enough room in the dining room to fit all the guests. So if people elected not to have a meal there, they could go to town. So we went to town for dinner often, mostly, as I remember, at Corey's. Gus Corey's was a noted restaurant. It was American, Chinese, Italian. But the old timers would know it, and most hotel people didn't know. You never left the grounds, but because of that fire, we left the grounds and mostly went for dinner.
You got that experience of getting off campus you might not have gotten if you're going to one of the big flagship hotels. Yeah, yeah. And what did that mean to you as a kid, if anything, coming up to the mountains?
Oh well, I mean, it was just not that I had to get away. I was enjoying the city, but it was just to meet new people, to meet new stuff, to get a little more active, see people outside of my normal familiarities. And the fresh air and sunshine, you know. Yeah, the smallest buildings in my neighborhood were six stories. So, you know, you didn't get a lot of air, sunshine, and et cetera. So it was good to get up here and get that stuff. And, you know, you got bitten, you got sunburned. You know, you suffered some of the excesses of being up here, but that was fine to suffer. We used to go for about 2 or 3 weeks, standard. Your father came for 2 weeks or so, another week or two. He just came for weekends. That was kind of, I'm not talking about bungalow people, different, but that was kind of standard stuff.
What were you like when you were like 18 in the city and then ultimately you say, okay, well, I'm just going to try going upstate?
Oh, I graduated high school at 16. I did different. I worked here. I worked there. I did come up once a weekend or two to the old Commodore on Swan Lake to work as a busboy. My friends were there. I putzed around and I went to college. I went to Brooklyn College. That didn't work out. So I was aware of the mountains, and I said, let me see. But I said, and I went to Jupiter Agency in the city, Manhattan. They were kind of the agency, a noted agency. And, you know, they gave you the papers, and I went to the Concord. And, you know, which was year-round. And, you know, it had its pluses and otherwise. But it was a good place to work, if somewhat overwhelming for a neophyte.
When you first got to work at the Concord, you first seeing the Concord, did it feel different than the hotels that you were going to as a little kid?
Yeah. I mean, from 80 rooms to 1,200 rooms. If you worked in the dining room in the Concord, that was kind of your life. Even though you had, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people working in other departments, the dining room was so intense and kind of all-encompassing that was, in a way, that was your life. You know, socially, gambling and drugs a little, you know, whatever you could get there. And money, you made.
You're talking about like the culture among the young people that were working there through the summer.
And some of the ones that are lifers, as they call them, which I became a lifer, if you will, you know, that stayed year-round.
So how did you get to Woodstock?
Motorcycle. But I think you meant more, how did I come to go there? Yeah.
I actually mean it both ways. It's the way I ask that question, that people can answer as they want, because it's always an interesting story, from how people heard about it to who they went with to the actual modes of transportation, right, and how you even got in and out of the site. All of that's interesting to me.
Okay, good. So, you know, we heard of it. I read the papers every day, generally all the time anyway. I'm a newspaper reader. And we heard about the festival going to near Saugerties or near Woodstock, New York. It had problems over there, so it moved down to the town of Walker or outside of Middletown. And that was just about, it was such a big event, that was probably in the record almost daily about what was happening with that because of the big acts that were coming. And then,
so you were following this saga in the papers, saying, like, hey, this thing's going to be happening somewhere.
Yes. Wow, are they going to be up here? All those acts, it just sounded like pie in the sky almost. Once I know this thing was happening in my backyard, there was no way I couldn't go, as long as they gave me the weekend, but I would have taken off anyway. So I got that weekend off of
all. I can imagine there was a lot of, you know, young people working at the big resorts that wanted that same weekend off.
Yes. And a lot took off, whether they had the permission or not. And other hotels, too. Yeah. But, you know, it was, it couldn't be happening in my backyard with me taking a look. And so that's how I went. And, you know, we had other people we were going to meet there. And someone once had tents, but we never met. I mean, they went, we saw them afterwards, but it was tough to make appointments to meet someone there.
Yeah, I bet. The first thing that you remember seeing that really sticks with you is just coming over the rise and seeing so many people.
You saw the full, yes, the field just almost full. It got fuller later on, but first of all, the physical layout, the bowl, the natural amphitheater was awesome, and then to see it populate with the sea of people was almost breathtaking. I mean, the only other thing was breathtaking was just my first glimpse of the Grand Canyon, which was jaw-dropping. And this was jaw-dropping too, but this was also the natural theater and the people. So this was both. The Grand Canyon is just the physicality. You know, here it was the physical bowl and that the people were there. It was.
Well, again, you could see all sorts of things in the Catskills. You could see natural wonders. You could see hills, trees, waterfalls, right. And deer. Or you could see dining rooms full of, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people. But you don't usually see a field full of tens of thousands of people.
Absolutely, very well said. Right. That was a sight. And in the book, I have a picture of that.
Now, your book is specifically about the medical response at Woodstock. Did you have any connection to the medical response at Woodstock when you were actually there?
No, except, excuse me, for my one Woodstock joke. I provided fluid replacement therapy. I sold snow cones at the intersection of West Shore Boulevard and Heard Road. So that was my, I didn't become an EMT till some years later, and I became a nurse later than that.
Okay, but this is the first time hearing about these snow cones. You're working hard in the summer at the resort. You get the weekend off to go to the biggest party on the face of the earth, and you start getting a side hustle going? How did that happen?
Oh, I bump into my friend, Marty Edwards, who also kind of conked out of the Concord that weekend. He was entrepreneurial. He started selling snow cones out of the trunk of his car at the northwest corner of that intersection. And I needed ice. It was so I see him there. So he said, "Myron, you want to help?" And I said, "What am I going to do?" He said, "Yeah." He showed me what he was doing. And he had one other person working. He was jammed 50-pound bags of ice, crushed ice from Reynolds Ice in Kiamisha. And so I helped. He said, "I'll give you $10 an hour." But I wasn't planning to work there. I wanted a party. But you were right in the center of things, so I couldn't pass that up. And also, I was getting free snow cones. You know, that's a deal. So after 4 or 5 hours of running out of crushed ice, Marty asked me to go to Reynolds Ice to refill. And I knew the rack road. It still was over a two-hour trip. And then I filled the car with ice at Reynolds. They were 50-pound bags of ice for $2 to the ceiling. It was a refrigerator, because that was going to be the last thing. Once you ran out of ice this time, you know there was no going back.
Yeah. Wow, so you actually were able to go out, load up on ice, and then you came back?
Yes. No, the whole thing was about 6 hours, 6 or 7 hours, including, and then I had to go to Kelly's Candy on Lampfield Avenue to buy more syrup. You know, we had a bottle, you couldn't just sell. The reality is, there was a time when you ran out of syrup, so you were just selling the crushed ice for the same thing for the 50 cents. You couldn't, but when the ice was melting, we did not sell the water. It was nice, fresh, cold water, but did not sell the water.
Right.
That was a freebie. In 2019, the 50th anniversary, the PBS documentary, Woodstock 3 Days That Defined a Generation, came out. It was a major documentary. I'm in it selling. I'm the guy selling snow cones. It's my three and a half.
What?
It's my
Is this
friend.
A photo? Is it film?
Oh, no, it's a visual. It's me making snow cones.
You can you add.
Absolutely. It's in my camera. If I knew how to access my camera, I'll show you.
Huh?
Oh, no, this is my the
wow.
And there I was. As I say, my 3.5 seconds of fame.
Oh, boy, what'd you think when you saw that? I mean,
a friend sent me. He said, "Myron, I just saw you. I didn't see it while watching the thing." He says, "I'm sending you a file. Look at it." I said, "What? What are you so excited about?" Bingo. There I am.
So wow. That's great.
Yeah, no, I didn't know. Yes.
Well, I've seen it, too. I remember that documentary. I just didn't know to look for you. So now next time I see it, keep an eye out for
that
you.
Was 50, over 50 years ago. I don't look like I did then. So, you know, take that as an allowance.
I'll keep it in mind.
You're listening to a conversation with Sullivan County author and Woodstock historian Myron Gattell. There's more of this conversation to come on Catskill Character.
On this Old House Radio Hour, the great dishwasher debate is finally settled. Are you loading yours the right way?
The corners of your dishwasher are where it's going to struggle to provide a lot of cleaning action. If you have dirty items, you definitely don't want to be placing them at the corners.
Plus, author Colson Whitehead revisits a family home that tells more than a century of Black history. That's this week on This Old House Radio Hour. Sunday morning at 7 on Radio Catskill.
This Week in This American Life.
I just think we're opening a whole can of worms here that we don't want
to
be.
To better understand testosterone and its effects, I and the staff of the radio show get our testosterone levels checked to see who has the most.
For the men, I think it'll be a big deal. You'll know when you're talking to each other who beat you. I think it'll change everything.
This whole thing is going to lead to heartbreak.
Tonight at 6 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Catskill Character. I'm your host, Donna Fellenberg. Today, we're taking a trip back to the original Woodstock Music and Arts Fair with Myron Gittell, local author and historian. In the first half of the show, we learned about his early life and the path that took him to Woodstock. Now, let's learn how and why he wrote this book, Woodstock 69, 3 Days of Peace, Music, and Medical Care. Here's Myron Gittell speaking with Jason Dole at Radio Catskill Studios.
So, Myron, how did you come to write this book?
I became an EMT in 1973 and used to go to, you know, county ambulance meetings. And we used to have a mock disaster at least once a year. So at one of these, a fellow, Al Whitaker, who was a member of the Woodburn Squad for many years, he said, do you know where the biggest disaster was? Now, this is about in the mid to late 70s.
Right.
Do you know where the biggest disaster was? So people said, no, where was the biggest disaster? He said, right in our backyard in Woodstock. Not that it was the worst by degree. It was the most in the country documented was at Woodstock in our own backyard.
So just the scale of people, so the scale of medical incidences.
Yes, yes, the number. There were a couple of deaths, and, you know, it wasn't like 100 people got burned, but there was a lot of different things happened there. So that I'm a history buff, and here I'm an EMT, so I said that perked up my ears, and I started to do more research over the years. I had more interviews with Al Whitaker at the Liberty Museum about the mid-'80s. We had a program about the medical care at the festival. So people there came that were at the festival, and it was, you know, well-publicized in the newspapers. So and came and told their stories, which was great because those stories hadn't been gathered before. And I took notes. I did some recording. And then after a while, I said, I got to put this together. I said, I got to put a book together. And I'd never written a book. I wrote here, I wrote there. But then I connected with a friend of mine, the guy Jack Kelly, who's a journalist, and he helped me put it together, help with the interviews, organize it, and help with the writing. I thought I was going to have it ready for the 30th anniversary in 99, but I had it ready for 2009, the 40th. I was 10 years late, but that's okay.
And the name of the book's Woodstock 69, 3 Days of Peace, Music, and Medical Care. Myron Gittell, RN, with Jack Kelly, EMT. And the folks listening, they can't see it, but I love the photo that you got for the cover here. It's iconic in the sense that you picture Woodstock, what do you got? You got people filling the streets and cars haphazardly parked along the road. And that's what you see here. But square, front and center, is one of those old school ambulances that if you watch the movie and you know if you know what they are, you know what you're looking at. They're kind of like a 1950s station wagon, right, or a hearse, you know, but kitted out with emergency lights and a white top.
They were on the same chassis as hearses. So, yes, you just called it, Jason, iconic. It was done by a guy, Bill Pierce, in my research. He was at Woodstock. He was a look photographer. And not only the ambulance says Sullivan County on it, and it is so crowded, and this and the caption was going into sick bay. So the medical tent or medical facilities were You could see the ambulance was being led into the ground.
Yeah, and now that you look, I can kind of see those people there by the gate. It looks like they're either trying to open the gate or they're trying to get out of the way at least. So I guess right. That ambulance is trying to get in where that gate is.
Yes,
there.
Yes.
Okay.
So
okay.
The caption was ambulance going into sick bay.
So a big part of the Woodstock story, I mean, the biggest part of the Woodstock story is all the people came, you know, and then the other side of that coin is like, but they got out of it okay for the most part, how many people were there. And part of that was the kindness and attentiveness of the local folks who, you know, helped out however they could, the interactions of the locals and these people that came. And that's a big part of your medical book as well, right?
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, I wanted to show, I mean, Woodstock Ventures, they hired doctors and nurses, but it was also, you know, every area here was covered by volunteer ambulance corps, neighboring counties as well. So, and, you know, so people woke up. It was just another day. They got called. They wound up, because the roads were so impassable, they wound up have the Liberty Airport beyond where Grossinger's was a staging area. It was an active airport in those days. So helicopters would take people from there. They just had to get there to the site. So, and some people stayed over. So they woke up a normal day. They know, oh, there's a Woodstock thing. They wound up to be helping out at the most amazing party of the time, or of all times, I don't know.
I mean, they were calling doctors and nurses in from everywhere locally that would have spare doctors or nurses, correct?
Yes, yes, yes. That's one of the points. Because of the crowds just coming and coming and coming, and with the state police and the media try to put out, and also through the instigation of Woodstock Ventures, who put it together, is stop. Stop where you are. Turn around if you could. We are socked in mud, literally and figuratively, here. It's dangerous. So there was a lot of public service announcements by radio stations to try to get people to turn around, to change the course of what they were doing. Also, other radio public service announcements were asking for doctors and nurses, volunteers, to come. Now, they wanted guests not to come, and they needed health care providers. So those public service announcements went out in the media. But what I'm trying to find out is that people talk about those radio and this radio announcement, and it's part of Woodstock lore. But I would love to find those, if anyone has any radio. I've done research already. I've checked with the Poli Center in Manhattan for radio and TV. I've checked with NPR archivist, and nobody has them. But I would love to find, if they got to be somewhere, the actual public service announcements that was asking for medical help and asking people not to come.
Getting the actual recording.
That's what I want.
And I just want to tell the listener, that's how we got Myron here today. Because this is the thing you're really seeking out right now. This is the thing you really want to try to get. So you're here in part to get the word out about this. I will tell you, as a informal Woodstock historian myself, and the research that I've done, the only thing I've ever come across that even comes close to this was a promotional spot for before the festival that's telling people about the bands that are coming. They're playing on the radio stations down the city.
I have that.
Yeah, but any announcements on the radio during the festival, I've never heard.
Yeah, unless someone recorded, some fan. That's what I'm hoping. Because the festival really wound up to be, it still would have been, but those announcements of telling people to turn away and bringing in doctors and nurses and other EMTs, that really had a significant, I think, impact on the whole festival. You know, on what's totally on its impact and really how it wound up from a safety point of view, which was my... So I think if we could find that would help documentary-wise. We all know what happened. We all know there were radio, but I just would love to get that documentary evidence. But
okay, I'm going to put a further line underneath this for the listener to say, like, part of it is getting people to think about who was around in this region, whether we're talking about upstate radio stations or even radio stations that might have been down in the city, who was around at that time that may have had a cassette or reel-to-reel recorder and was known to maybe record radio broadcasts. That's really what we're looking for. Yeah. Somebody that might have access to vintage archival recordings from this one specific weekend in August 1969.
Correct. That's what I'm looking for. I know. You know, it's a long shot, but a long shot is better than no shot.
We're going to be putting this out on the radio. We're going to be putting this out on the web. Do you want to tell people if they have a lead, if they think they have a lead, if they think they've got something like this, how can they get a hold of you, Myron?
Okay, MyronGitt@yahoo.com, MyronGitt@yahoo.com. So that's your – and half the people in the county know, I shouldn't say that, but MyronGitt@yahoo.com. I'd appreciate that.
Okay.
And you know, if you have a lead I'll follow it.
We talk in this conversation a lot about, you know, the Woodstock history, your interest in that history and the medical aspect and your background, right. You know, as an RN, EMT. But bigger picture, you've done other work in local history. You've been a big part of like perpetuating the history and gathering the history of, you know, places like the Concord. I was just wondering, as we wrap up here, any thoughts about like what that means for this area, these various aspects of history that you're interested into, the importance of telling these stories. Why is it important to you?
I don't do it because it's important. I do it because I like it and it's interesting and it happens to be important. I mean, two of the biggest things that happened up here in this county that people can't say in other counties in a country is we had the Borscht Belt resort area, which was of the largest, certainly, resort areas in the country at the time. And we had Woodstock. So, yeah, it isn't that I did it because I've done also things. I reprinted a book on the 143rd Regiment of the Civil War. I had no family involved with that, but I wanted to do it. I did on the Black History of the Catskills. I reprinted that and got involved. It's all important. The big stuff is important as well as the small. And while I worked at the Concord and really the biggest, you know, there's a lot of interesting stories at some of the smallest hotels, smaller, as well as the bungalow colonies and the camps, you know, hundreds of camps here. That's a whole nother story.
Well, I'm just so grateful that you took the time today to tell us your parts of those stories and tell us your story, you know, both big and small, all aspects of it. I really appreciate this.
Oh, thanks for WJFF. Thank you.
You've been listening to a conversation with Sullivan County author and historian Myron Gittell. I want to thank Radio Catskill's Jason Dole for bringing us this conversation today, and I wish Myron the best of luck in his quest to find those lost Woodstock artifacts. That's it for this week's show. I'm Donna Fellenberg. Thank you so much for listening this morning, and please join me again next week for more conversation with fabulous characters of the Catskills and beyond, here on Catskill Character.
Support comes from Seminary Hill, open Thursday through Sunday in Calicoon, featuring Dinner with a View, live music on Fridays and weekend brunch, orchard and cidery tours and tastings every Sunday at 11 a.m. This summer, picnics, line dancing, and rural upskilling workshops return. Lessons in foraging, pickling, and baking sourdough. Tickets available on Resy. More information at seminaryhill.co. From generous funding from the Public Media Bridge Fund and from listeners like you.
On last week's Wait, Wait, Tom Papa warned everyone that the cyclospora outbreak is not that much fun.
And heads up, this is one explosion you do not look cool walking away from in slow-mo.
I'm Peter Sagal. Join us this week to see what else is bursting out of the week's news and a conversation with the dreamboat of Abbott Elementary, Tyler James Williams. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, Bella Freud. She's a clothing designer and host of Fashion Neurosis, a conversation podcast about the connection between clothes and identity. It's an unconventional setup where Freud's guests lie on a couch. Her great-grandfather was the legendary psychoanalyst Sigmund Freud. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures, here on this public radio station.
Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Sign up for Radio Catskill's free weekly newsletter. Get the latest local news, culture, and things to do in your inbox every Friday. Stay connected and informed with Radio Catskill's newsletter. Subscribe at wjffradio.org.